This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Patreon supporters. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the podcast.
Oh, sweet pea, I know sometimes you want to be like everybody else. But you know what? I like you special.
The Act gives us yet another take on the murder of Dee Dee Blanchard by the daughter she kept sick for her own pathological benefit. History Detectives gives us yet another overly didactic look at a Victorian axe murder spree. What do these cases have in common? Well, it's possible that both were better treated by the original long-form articles that brought them to our attention, but Tara Ariano and I are going to talk about all that and more. So throw some pizza in the blender. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 90. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. I am thrilled to welcome my non-carnal life partner, Tara Ariano, back to the guest chair. Hello, T-Bone.
Hello.
So, The Act on Hulu, yet another take on Gypsy and Dee Dee Blanchard, this time in an 8-part miniseries. That is the subject of our most wanted section. This is yet another one in which I feel like providing a case file on this is probably superfluous, but just in case, from Hulu's landing page. The Act is a seasonal anthology series that tells startling, stranger-than-fiction true crime stories. Season 1 follows Gypsy Blanchard, a girl trying to escape the toxic relationship she has with her overprotective mother, Dee Dee. Her quest for independence opens a Pandora's box of secrets, one that ultimately leads to murder. End quote. This is, of course, the Munchausen's by proxy case, made famous first by Michelle Dean's BuzzFeed piece and then by Aaron Lee Carr's documentary Mommy, Dead and Dearest, which I talked about with Stephanie Green way back in episode 9.
Yow.
Yes. So this case has been in the air for a while, but if you are not familiar with it and you don't want to be spoiled, just skip ahead to the cold case section. Likewise, if you do know the case, but you want to be surprised as to how it unfolds here. As you're listening to this, 3 episodes have dropped, but we had screeners of 5 and we'll be working ahead. I watched all 5. Tara?
Yeah, I watched all 5.
Michelle Dean co-created and co-writes many of the episodes, and I went into this being happy for her about that, but still wondering if this story needed the full Dirty John 360 treatment. I will say that I did not take that many notes while I was watching. This story and the way it's told here just carried me right along. Tara, overall, what did you think of the first 5? Acting, length, production design, any meta thoughts?
Ooh, well, by the time we get toward the end of these, I would say this series is a good proof of concept that the internet is bad and we should be scared, because by the time Gypsy, you know, internet meets Nick, like, it's clear this kid is not right, and he's been exposed to some things he probably shouldn't have thanks to the internet that he, like, never would have known otherwise. They never would have met otherwise. I mean, would Gypsy still have murdered Dee Dee if she had never, you know, encountered Nick? I don't know, maybe, but certainly the two of them, you know, they were a force multiplier, and, you know, I can't think of another medium that would have united them in this way and, like, curdled both of their minds at the same time.
Yeah, Oxygen had a whole series on this called hashtag killer post, which was not good. And the title was not good. And the narration was not good.
Sure.
But it could have gone on for 17 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been the Forensic Files of Oxygen, because there are so many cases where I think you can say that.
Yeah.
I think this case is not completely unique, but different from most of these in that Gypsy had like very little exposure to the internet and the social media that her peers, whichever those people are, depending on which age you believe she actually is.
Right.
That she sort of had to learn this as she went in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, early on, Dee Dee overhears some of the conversation that Gypsy is having with what I assume is a composite character, her sort of neighbor friend from across the street, Lacey, played by Anna Sophia Robb, who, just as a side note, perfectly cast as the like aspirational, glamorous teenage neighbor that you wish you were. Like, she's really good in this part. I thought I loved
she
her.
Really is.
Loved
she's
her
adorable.
Since the Carrie Diaries, as you know.
Same. And I looked up. I still miss the Carrie Diaries. Mm-hmm. Hashtag I'm not a crackpot. Mm-hmm. And found out that Mouse is on Glow.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You've been telling me to watch that for some time now, and now I am extra motivated. Anyway. Sidebars.
So anyway, Dee Dee overhears them having like a conversation about boys or something, and she gets mad at Lacey and takes her aside and says like, Gypsy doesn't even know what sex is. And I was like, doesn't she? And then I thought, oh, maybe she actually doesn't. Like, it's possible that Dee Dee has kept her that sheltered such that like, as soon as any boy comes into her orbit, she's like, you know, ready to pounce, really.
Well, and the reference that I keep thinking, that I kept thinking of, God help me and you listeners, was My Sweet Audrina, mm-hmm. by V.C. Andrews.
Yeah.
That they just like reset all the clocks in the house and kept telling her that she was 7 years old, even though she had boobs.
Like, yeah.
This is basically what Dee Dee was doing to Gypsy to some extent. And then by keeping her so walled away from the world for, you know, germaphobe reasons, ostensibly, or, you know, you're too weak, you can't walk.
Yeah.
Like, who knows what contact Gypsy has had, if any, with sort of regular workaday. Like, she doesn't go to school.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
that peer group is not available. I did think the episode sometimes ran a little long. As we were getting further into it, like you said, you know, proof of concept that the internet is bad, mm-hmm. slash designed, like it or not, to serve as a force multiplier for some of our worst instincts.
Yep.
But also, like, there was a sequence in the third episode where they're at a con and it just seemed to go on kind of a while. Gypsy starting to sneak out, I enjoyed the processy parts of her kind of trying to get around Dee Dee by offering to do errands and then go get a burner phone, mm-hmm. or stealing money that was also scammed from other people,
right,
by Dee Dee, and like quickly buying a laptop and doing all of this. Like, I enjoyed those parts, but some of it did seem a little inefficient, or sort of forgetting that the people who are going to be watching this are probably familiar with the case. Did you feel like this was made for people who knew nothing about it, or for people who already knew everything about it?
That's a good question. I agree that it did feel a little flabby. When I saw that we had 5 episodes, I thought, oh, well, this is the whole thing. Especially by the time I got to episode 4, I was like, well, this seems like it's wrapping up in the next episode. And then when we leave off, like, no, there's still quite a bit to go. Particularly considering that, like, even if you didn't already know the case, it starts with a dead body. So,
yeah.
Like, get to it, you know? Like, it keeps looping back, you know, it goes sequentially from the past storyline. And then basically from the screeners that we've seen, we're still on the night of the discovery of the body. But I agree that it could have been faster. I don't know who it's for. I mean, I don't, the BuzzFeed story was certainly a sensation among people we know, but I don't know how, how representative that is of the public. And even, you know, the HBO documentary, probably is not that widely seen. You know, it's not Game of Thrones. So I feel like this is probably meant to be Hulu's American Crime Story, but they're starting with a case that, I mean, I think it's probably as known as Dirty John. So that case might be the best analogy for it. So
yeah, that's a good point. I have in my notes a couple of places, mostly in our cold case section, but it's like, is it me and how much time I spend with true crime properties or...
Right.
Because I have just no concept. Like, mm-hmm. in my various Twitter feeds, like, this is, you know, there is a shorthand.
Yeah.
For this. But overall, I mean, the story is so nuts. Like, there is something about a Munchausen case that's yeah. like, you just can't stop looking at it.
No, it's true. And I was about to say, it's also having a moment, but I don't want to say what the other big media product is because the Munchausen part is kind of a spoiler, so I won't. But it does seem like it's having a moment is such a gross way to say it. But it seems to be resurfacing after having been kind of a procedural plot point, I want to say like in the 90s, and then it kind of went dormant for a while. But obviously this particular case has reignited interest in it for sure.
Yeah, for sure. You called for a few clips. Do you want to introduce the first one that you asked for?
Oh, sure. So this is from the first episode. Gypsy and Dee Dee have just moved into this house on this cul-de-sac. And I think we're supposed to think that it's kind of like a semi hardscrabble neighborhood in Missouri, but those houses are huge.
Like, seriously, they looked really nice.
They're really like, cute. Mm, yeah. Dee Dee and Gypsy's house has been... it's a Habitat for Humanity home, and we find out that one of their neighbors across the street, whose name is Mel, who's played by Chloe Sevigny, Lacey's mother, sort of makes a kind of snide reference when she's starting to see that Dee Dee might not be totally on the up and up. She's like, yeah, I know all about your house. I helped build it. They're at a party to try and win people over, and then... this is when they've just gone over. This is before the party. They've just gone over to say hi and stuff. And Lacey's boyfriend is over, and Lacey gives her a Coke, and Gypsy drinks some. And we find out afterwards, as Dee Dee is trying to explain to Gypsy why she cannot do things that people her age do, like drink Coke in clip two.
Baby, do you know what a severe reaction looks like? First, you start coughing and hacking. And then your whole body gets itchy like you're covered with spiders or something. And then your face blows up like a balloon. It gets all red and puffy. And then your throat starts closing up, and before you know it, my baby's gone.
I won't do it again. I won't leave you, I promise.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I believe you. I believe you.
Sorry.
I believe you. Oh, you're such a good girl to me, Gypsy Rose. Oh, we take care of each other, don't we?
Yeah. So again, like this points to how unworldly Gypsy is and how easy it is for Dee Dee as her sole caregiver her entire life. And as far as Gypsy knows, like the only person who cares about her, because Dee Dee has been representing her biological father, who we have not seen yet. We've heard phone calls, as like not involved in her life at all when he sends checks and he calls and tries to talk to her on her birthday, and like Dee Dee keeps them apart. But like coming so close after leaving Neverland, it's like such a horrible reminder of how easy it is for adults to exploit children's trust in them. And that scene, because we know it's bullshit. I mean, at this point, we don't know it, but we know that her scaremongering description of what will happen to Gypsy if she drinks Coke is like it's horrible. I mean, and this is like the least of all the terrible things that she does, but like as one of the first things we see, it's, and the creepy music, like it's a really good encapsulation of how Dee Dee manipulated her.
Yeah, I think that the performances by the two leads are both really good. Patricia Arquette sort of making a little cottage industry for herself of like Emmy bait felony frumps.
Which, she basically said that on Colbert last week. Like, she's like, this is my year of difficult women. Like, yep.
Yeah, that's a one way to spin it. Yeah, I think she's great. The wheedling tone and the position that she constantly puts Gypsy in of just like giving her guilt, you know, we have a clip later that she really leans into that. And the production and wardrobe are flawless. Just these like shapeless, I'm too busy taking care of my daughter to look in a window, like jumpers and so much pink.
That's because that's part of the scam too, is like to infantilize both of them to make them both look pathetic. And so that people will want to give them money because like they don't even know how to dress. Like that's how far it extends.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sort of torn because I kind of wanted, you referred to that snide remark that Mel made, and Mel does see, like, there's apparently a sort of ongoing shoplifting scam that Dee Dee and Gypsy pull, that it's sort of unclear what Gypsy thinks or understands about this. Like, she clearly knows that it goes on, and then Dee Dee steals a script pad later, and it's, again, unclear. Like, Gypsy clearly sees it, but I don't know that the show sort of wants to say one way or the other what Gypsy understands about that, and there may be no knowing that.
Right.
But, you know, Dee Dee, like, was basically a known scam artist, and the fact that they did move to this town probably, if I recall the other materials correctly, kind of one step ahead of doctors in Louisiana. Figuring out what was really going on. And then Mel happens to see them at the mall when Dee Dee is sliding a necklace into Gypsy's like wheelchair backpack and is about to call her on it at a party. But then fortunately for Dee Dee, she spots Gypsy licking a cupcake and gets out of it. But that's sort of an interesting part of it to me, that the Gypsy was not Dee Dee's only scam, and that to get away from her, Gypsy had to pull scams on her. And sometimes that isn't maybe pushed hard enough on, but I just like cons and, you know, the process of cons. But anyway, this is a clip where Mel is like, really? And the number of bitch please faces that Chloe 70 pulls in this role are really glorious. Here's clip 3.
Oh, Dee Dee, I ain't one to keep my mouth shut. You know I saw what y'all were doing at the mall.
Oh, Gypsy has a little problem. She's got the mind of a child. Sometimes she takes things.
Cut the shit. I saw you. Just think it's funny, this whole perfect mom act you got going.
It's not an act.
Oh, come on, Dee Dee. You play like you're the saint. You got your little girl helping you steal from the jewelry rack?
Well, you're right. I just... Gypsy... She's gonna die young. She deserves to have nice things once in a while. And disability just doesn't cover it. And her father, he just...
I'm just saying, I think it's pretty funny that you...
Gypsy! Yo, Dee Dee, what's wrong?
Oh, shit, she's allergic.
I mean, yeah, like this scene is an excellent encapsulation of how Dee Dee gets away with this, that people just don't want to step in the quicksand of her rationalizing because... you know, she's just hard to deal with on purpose.
Right. But also the built-in excuse that made it easy for them to steal the necklace in the first place, which is that the chair makes them invisible. Like, unless you're directly paying attention to them, you know, it's like the premise of Good Girls too. Where it's like you use what you have, and like no one is going to suspect a doting mother and a girl who's using a wheelchair like you know. And at the same time, she's going to die young. She deserves nice things. Like, that might also work on Mel too. Like, it's all enmeshed.
Yeah. And on top of that, like, she has the scam and then she has the escape hatch of the scam, which is that she has the mind of a 7-year-old. Like, well, yeah, she probably does at your like at your structuring of her life.
Right.
We do meet a doctor once they've moved to Missouri, Dr. Chandra, who is like kind of onto Dee Dee from the jump. I was a bit disappointed that she, after the clip that we're about to hear, she kind of disappears from the narrative, at least for now. Mm-hmm. If anyone's ever doing this to me, I would really like a Dr. Chandra to just offer me like the Coca-Cola of truth and be like, I got you.
Yeah.
But in this clip, we see how even when they can get Gypsy alone, doctors basically do not have time to chip away at the defenses that Dee Dee has built for herself around Gypsy in clip four.
My mom is my best friend. All she wants to do is keep me safe.
I believe you, sweetheart. I know that. I do. And it's really clear that she loves you very much, right? But sometimes, even parents can get confused. And sometimes even parents need help. And maybe this is the help that both of you need. Go ahead. Just take one sip. And I promise I will do the rest.
Yeah. I mean, and you're just like, take the sip. But there again, I think the show does a good job not exactly that, like, equivocating kind of on what Gypsy knows or right. understands. Like, right. this is around the time when she's beginning to realize that she, like, her documents have like 4 different years of birth on them, and that perhaps, like, she doesn't really understand what's going on, but she knows that it's not right. Mm-hmm. And then she goes to a con and everything begins to unravel. Cosplay murdered Dee Dee Blanchard. I'm joking. You called for our next clip. What struck you about this conversation between her and a new con friend?
Yeah, this is one of the Wolverines that they encounter. One of them is sweet on her and the other likes Dee Dee, who's played by the other one is Dean Norris. This guy, I've seen him before, but I don't know his name. But he...
Yeah, same.
Dee Dee acquires a burner phone and starts texting this guy whose name is Scott, and he is also lying to her. He has represented himself as a surgeon while we see him serving a woman in a nursing home who, like, bats her tray out stuff. So, like, okay, again, the internet is bad. I know texting isn't quite the internet, but kind of, like, this is a mutual catfishing situation. But she sort of sums up her life in clip 5.
How's life? I want to know more about you.
I've been keeping busy, hanging out with my friends. Sometimes I feel like it's my job just to make people happy.
I'm sure you don't have to work hard at that. I mean, after all, you charm me, right?
I mean, it is her job to make people happy. She has nothing else to do. And, like, this is also part of Dee Dee's manipulations. Like, we need help, and you need to be complicit with people that you meet and be sweet and seem agreeable and, you know, don't let your true feelings about anything show. You know, this is as much of a job as she will ever have, I guess.
Yeah. And it's clear from a few prior scenes when she's being asked about things by doctors, by attorneys, by whomever, that Dee Dee will put her hand warningly on Gypsy's arm, and Gypsy, again, on some visceral level, understands that this is the gig.
Well, and sometimes to make sure that she does what she's supposed to or acts the way she's supposed to, we also see that Dee Dee drugs her so that she, when a person comes from Family and Children's Services to, after someone calls them, who I guess is Dr. Chandra, right? That's who placed the call. So yeah, Dee Dee drugs her so that she seems extra dopey, so that when Dee Dee says she has the mind of a 7-year-old and she is as slow answering as she is because she's on drugs, you know, that's also part of what she does.
Yeah. And it's clear from the next clip that Gypsy has absorbed this as the way things are always done by everyone.
Yep.
Scott gets in a bar fight and it's not exactly clear, but somehow it's communicated to Gypsy where he is. And she puts on her red Jean Grey wig and somehow like sneaks out of the house and visits him in the emergency room. And he's like
walking, but she gets in a cab and walks.
Yeah. And he's like, doesn't even recognize her and is simultaneously like flabbergasted,
drunk.
But
and
also
drunk still.
Yes. And drunk and turned on
and concussed. And, it's a lot.
Yes. And has had his nose rebroken. And this happens. Clip 6.
Poor baby. Gosh. Have they given you anything for your pain? Anything?
Just a local. They reset my nose.
You need a Vicodin or maybe a Xanax or what about a Percocet or an Ativan? No, I can
ask
for you.
They said they wouldn't because I've been drinking.
Silly, you don't need to tell them the whole truth when you're in pain.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Absolutely perfect Dee Dee cadence there too. So
yep, totally.
I mean, my feeling has always been not that Gypsy was justified in arranging or having a role in what happened, but
no,
that
murder is bad. That's the official position of this podcast, right?
Yes, of course it is. But
bad. Yep, but
yeah. And yeah. Also that you know, there were hints in other properties about the case that sort of like mother like daughter, mm-hmm. and that Gypsy was as big of a con artist as Dee Dee, and my feeling on that was always like, well, maybe, but that's possibly a nurture thing,
right?
As much as that, like, what else could she be? She literally was not around anyone else.
Yeah.
98.8% of the time. Mm-hmm. So I still don't think she's necessarily responsible for becoming a con artist or absorbing this way of interacting with the world.
No, but
killing her mom, she's responsible. Don't get me wrong. But
sure. But the reason that I called for that clip with Scott was that, like, because her interactions with other people have been so limited, like, she's only learned one love language and that's it. Like, this kind of act of service is what she's been on the receiving end of from Dee Dee, and like, it's fucked up, but like, she literally doesn't know another way to be, and so pressing drugs on him is like, that's her way of caring for him.
Yeah And it's like, this is how you are useful and how you exist in a relationship, mm-hmm. is to provide Schedule 8 narcotics.
Well, it's her job to make other people happy. That's what she's trying to do here for Scott.
Yeah. So yeah, they end up making out, but Dee Dee finds them, and then Nick happens, and it's sort of all downhill from there. So in our next clip, it's yet more Dee Dee self-pityingly pulling attention off of Gypsy and back to herself.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else about clip 7 before?
Yeah, at this point, you know, years have passed. Dee Dee is not doing well. She has diabetes that she is not doing anything to manage, from what we've heard from a doctor. And her hair is increasingly crazy, so that we can, it's like a barometer of her state of mind.
I know, the degradation of the coif is really, really amazing. Not that it started from that high a point, but
right.
Yes.
But by any of the measures of any of Gypsy's IDs, she is 18. I believe she's actually 22 at this point, or we might not be there yet, but her birthday is definitely approaching. And so Dee Dee is worried that if Gypsy is able to start signing things for herself, she's going to figure out a way to get away from her. And so they go to a mall lawyer to try to get papers drawn up, making Dee Dee her legal guardian. But the lawyer basically says, like, Gypsy is clearly competent. A judge is not going to sign off on this because she's able to look after herself. And so Dee Dee is like stalking through the mall, spiraling into self-pity in clip 7.
I was only being honest.
Oh,
I know, Gypsy B, but we need those papers. Doctor, Medicaid, Make-A-Wish Foundation, disability, all of it. We could be homeless again. We could be in big trouble. Big trouble?
What does that mean?
Explain it to you later. I feel terrible.
Sorry, Mom.
Why am I always at the bottom of my list? I feel like no one cares for me.
So, again, this is like the sugar speech again in a different form, where it's like just scaremongering her with the most dire possibility of what could go wrong if Gypsy doesn't submit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really, I think the reason that this particular property sort of its reason for existing is that there's a lot that, because this quote character is no longer present and mm-hmm. cannot speak for herself, like, granted, what we would probably hear would not be satisfying, mm-hmm. but the act allows us to imagine the hows of this little toxic family unit, how Dee Dee kept Gypsy under her control, not just medically, mm-hmm. but mentally.
Yeah.
And how Gypsy, like Gypsy's occasional attempts to wriggle free that became increasingly like constant. You'll see in the visual aids, which are on social media, Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. I posted something on Twitter yesterday, you know, Gypsy downing most of a 2-liter of Coke,
mm-hmm.
which ends up like rotting her teeth. And then she has her own little scam with the dentist that she can't admit that her teeth are rotting, not because Dee Dee had her salivary glands removed, which is a, you know, pretty legit reason, but because she's been eating frosting and washing it down with Coca-Cola like every night
after Dee Dee falls asleep.
Yes.
On Ambien or whatever she takes. Sleepy baby.
Yes. Sleepy baby. Yes. All of the medications are labeled like sleepy baby, shaky baby. I shouldn't laugh. It's really quite a fully realized production, I will say that.
Yeah. But the thing, the other thing about that speech that she gives is that, like, that all is true. Like, Gypsy probably could have figured out how to lead an independent life, but she would have needed a lot of help. And she, and in order to get it, she would have had to betray Dee Dee. So, you know, in order for Dee Dee's existence to continue in its current state, like, they have to, this codependence has to continue for both of their sakes.
It's awful. And there's no, like, certainly Dee Dee's pathology would not allow her to be like, it's time to start, like, not walking it back, but it's time to start unwinding this. And, like, let's move one more time, leave the chair, miracle cure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've changed my name slightly a whole bunch of times already.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been done, but I don't think in her, like, in the depths of that illness, she would see.
No, and we see, you know, one of the more high-profile examples of what she scammed her way into is when Gypsy is named Child of the Year for whatever this organization is, and they get $5,000 at a big ceremony and sing "I'll Be There" to each other, and it's awful. but, like, you get it, and you sort of, it's like, well, if basically all Gypsy had to do to get this was be nominated and continue to be alive, you know, given all of the diseases that are, you know, we are given to understand are, you know, in perfect balance to keep her alive for now. But yeah, like if suddenly Dee Dee had no salivary glands, if Gypsy had no salivary glands, but could walk, like, that's going to mean less money to Dee Dee for the nest egg savings in the Ziploc bag. So yeah, it's
helpfully
not
fully labeled for viewers. This is
exactly
not how people do things.
But even like something as small as, we don't think you need your feeding tube in your stomach anymore, like, even that Dee Dee will not allow it to be removed. Like, even that small concession to Gypsy's yeah. independence is not permitted.
Because this is her job,
yeah.
sick as it is,
yep.
and she doesn't know how to do anything else.
Right.
So there's like no, that's the one thing that there's not a plan B mm-hmm. for.
Yeah, and we just see it as especially by the time we get to episode 5, like the house is just which has started out neat as a pin. It's all cute and pink inside, and then, you know, by this point it's hoarded. She's covering the windows because she's worried about people looking inside and seeing Gypsy walking around. There's just piles and piles and piles and piles of stuffed animals and trash bags and stuff. Like, it, you feel how claustrophobic it is. It's like literally dark and awful. It's an awful place yeah. to be.
Yeah, you really do feel it. And like just that sort of grubbiness
mm-hmm.
and not hand-to-mouth existence as we usually understand it, but the hand-to-mouth maintenance of this front
mm-hmm.
That or of this con, that it's like, well, the big store probably needs to close, but they can't.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that that's the act's like best raison d'etre, I guess, is to at least theorize with, since it was created by Michelle Dean, some degree of authority
mm-hmm.
as to what it was actually like to be in this situation. And
yeah.
I think they execute on that really well. Do I kind of want a spinoff series starring Mel and Lacey? Yes, I do. Because I like those actors.
Yeah.
And they really got some... They really got some pretty heavy hitters to act in this thing and direct it. Adam Arkin directed an episode. It's really well done. And I'm glad that it didn't feel, you know, like it didn't need to exist. Dirty John, I enjoyed, but it did feel a little like, I think we were all set, actually.
Well, see, but I didn't know anything about that case going into it. So, like, that was for me, I guess.
Okay.
Because I never listened to the podcast. I knew zero about that case.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think actually once I like listened to the podcast, then I went back and read the original articles and I was like, well, even the podcast didn't really need to exist. It was just kind of, you know, reading the articles to me. Not
yeah.
that there's anything wrong with that either. We do have one more clip, which I enjoyed. Tara actually called for it, but I enjoyed it because it's kind of amazing that in... like on the hem of a diabetic coma, basically, Dee Dee can still sell it
yeah.
to Gypsy effectively. So here's our last clip from this section.
As I figured out a way to keep us both safe. I need you to sign these papers. And everyone will know everything's the same between us. That you are still my child in your mind.
But I'm old enough to...
You're old enough to be blamed for everything we have ever stolen. Every lie we ever told. They're gonna blame you, Gypsy. That's what it is to be an adult. You'll be responsible. I'm trying to protect you from that.
Yeah. Yeah, right before this, Dee Dee had a whole seemingly irrelevant, like, aria of self-pity about being in jail and how it was the worst and people in there were dangerous. And now her scaremongering has turned to... like legal responsibility.
Right. And so she can't get the guardianship, but she's gotten a power of attorney and the lawyer has explained it's not the same, but she still gets her to sign it, which I was surprised that, I mean, I would assume that it needed to be notarized. There's a line for a witness, which no one witnesses Gypsy signing it, but she does sign. But at the same time, what she's been doing is talking to this weirdo named Nick online that she met through a Christian dating site. And the very next thing that happens is basically that the next time they talk, he says, I think I have something that you will enjoy. It's called BDSM. And like, oh, of course, the Gypsy's whole life is BDSM. Like, this is exactly what she would be primed for, given the relationship that she's had with Dee Dee. Like, yeah, of course she's ready to be tied up. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, his alter ego, Victor, who is a vampire, of course. And there's something so, it's never been clear to me based on other like case materials, what exactly his Nick Godejohn's deal was in terms of a diagnosis or a, like, he's not neurotypical.
Right. We see him at his job at a pizza place, and they're trying to show him, the guy who's his very, very nice patient boss is trying to show him how to put a pizza into the oven. And as soon as they open it, he's like, it's too hot. He gets flustered and he drops the pizza and then drops another one. Like, so the sensory thing makes me think he's somewhere on the spectrum.
Yeah. Or just clumsy like your girl Buncy.
I couldn't do that either. I thought the same thing.
It was like a documentary snippet of my time at the pizza place. Oh boy. I'm going to keep watching this. I wasn't sure that I would. I was like, 8 episodes. Like, what else can they have to say? But yeah. I assume that we get into the investigation.
Right.
And the interrogations and the trial, and that the show will be able to unpack a little bit what, like, how this all happened, not just what happened sort of via deduction, but, you know, what it was like to be there, which it's really good at doing in the lead up to the murder. So I'm in. I wish they weren't doing that Hulu thing where they drop one a week, because I'm impatient.
Yeah, now we're going to have to wait a month for more episodes, but yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry for our screener privilege, everybody.
Yes, exactly. If you've been really into this case, I recommend it. And I think it's also very good at constructing this world for people who never heard of it before. And the performances are really good. So yeah, thumbs up.
Yeah. For me personally, I will use this downtime while I'm waiting for Hulu to release more episodes to rewatch Mommy, Dead and Dearest, because
yes,
I feel like that would be a good use of my time.
Same. And the director of that, Aaron Lee Carr, has a documentary coming to HBO in the summer about the Michelle Carter case, where she basically text urged her on again, off again boyfriend.
Oh, that
to
girl, sure.
Take his life. So yeah, I mean, Carr is really good at this job, and I'm always excited to see what she has to say. So I might rewatch Mommy, Dead and Dearest as well. All right, on to some cheery axe murders in our cold case section. Today we are contemplating PBS's History Detective, Season 11, Episode 3, on an Austin, Texas case from the 1880s. Here's the case file from Wikipedia. A serial killer who became known as the Servant Girl Annihilator preyed upon the city of Austin, Texas during the years 1884 and 1885. This name originated with the writer O. Henry. The series of 8 axe murders were referred to by contemporary sources as the Servant Girl Murders, and they represent an early example of a serial killer operating in the United States 3 years before the Jack the Ripper murders in Whitechapel. End quote. The serial murder aspect of the case is both not as interesting as the O. Henry reference. FYI, the Gift of the Magi author was a crappy con himself who did some time for embezzling from the bank he worked at. And it's also not as interesting as this episode of History Detectives thinks it is. But we will get into it. Short version, the murders remain unsolved, and this show is not all that good. Tara.
Yeah, I agree. It's really boring. I'd never seen it before. You picked this, of course, because I now live in Austin, Texas. And I was surprised. I mean, I don't know why I was surprised. Like, it's called History Detectives. They're looking into a more than 100-year-old case and trying to see what they can figure out about it, which is like, maybe this is more compelling when you're dealing with something that's like slightly more contemporary. We were like, maybe people who were alive at the time could be on camera, but the best we do here is like the great grand niece of one of the victims.
Thank you for calling that out. There is literally no more useless a narrative tool than the surviving relative who's like, I mean, surviving. Like, this was her great grand aunt or something like that.
Yeah. Like, she's only like, the... yes. And basically all she can say is like, yeah, I guess I heard some stories. Like, she's also super old too. Like, maybe she doesn't remember everything that she was told, but probably no one that was alive when she was alive remembered anything about it either. Like, I don't know.
Her mom, who was the one victim's sister, was like, I don't want to talk about that.
Right.
Okay. Glad we brought a fucking camera crew out here.
Right.
This is PBS. We don't have all day to waste on this shit.
Yeah. The first note I took was right at the beginning of the episode, they refer to a series of murders that happened in the Deep South. And so may I say, as a Texan transplant, Texans get really pissed off when you call Texas the South. Never mind the Deep South, which you're it's the Southwest. Technically, you're not supposed to call it the South. But then
it's Texas. Just say it's Texas.
Just say it's Texas.
It's its own thing. It's fine.
Right. It's not part of the region. It's like the size of five other states. Anyway, there's also, before we even get into it, like so much throat clearing about what the show is and does, which like it's season 11. Like anyone at this point who's watching it probably gets it. And even I got it never having watched it before because it's called History Detectives. Like it's right there on the tin. But like we have to see them hanging around their office, like the three investigators chatting about it as if this is a TMZ editorial meeting. Like
making a crazy whiteboard. Like I mean, they seem very committed to the project, but good grief. Here's a little of that. Here's a little of that throat clearing in clip 9.
In the light of dawn, gruesome revelations. A room in violent disarray. A bloody axe and a broken, ravaged body. There would be 7 more killings that following year.
In many ways, it was more horrifying than the Jack the Ripper murders.
And the orgy of violence would almost tear the city apart.
They're starting to say the whole leadership of the city is broken.
3 years before Jack the Ripper terrorized London, 8 years before H.H. Holmes stalked the Chicago World's Fair. More butchery. Another woman terribly stabbed.
They can't imagine that the same person might be doing all these crimes.
Were the Austin deaths the work of the country's first serial killer?
Just put that anywhere. First of all, no, they weren't. I'll get to it.
Yeah.
Second of all, as opposed to hilarious stabbings, the writing, the music, that like intercut talking heads, like again, you are PBS, not ID. You don't have to pad. We're fine. Oh, I mean, here's the thing about this episode. This is the kind of show that I would have secretly loved to quote have to watch in school as auxiliary materials for something,
right?
But it is very it really feels like auxiliary materials that PBS often airs at like 2 a.m. and you'd have to set your VCR to get and then watch it for class. I mean, it just feels very much like stuff that is assigned.
Yeah.
And these aren't uninteresting cases, but in this case in particular, they're just hammering endlessly on the idea that this was a serial killer, but we didn't have the language for that yet.
Right.
And it's like, oh my God, like we get it. Like serial killers have always existed. We have a clip about that later, but there are many other interesting aspects of this crime that were not really investigated, like that in a bunch of cases the husband or boyfriend was indicted and put on trial for it, and then we kind of don't hear what happens in a lot of those cases, even though one of them is compared to the O.J. Simpson case in like how it was dominating the national press. So yeah, this was frustrating because I think there was good material here, but it just was packaged poorly.
Yeah, it's really thin gruel. And by the 50th reference to like this happened before Jack the Ripper, like, I get it.
Like, oh my God. No one is. Yes.
They don't try to claim like Jack the Ripper was inspired by these crimes. So like, who cares? Like, I don't understand.
Actually some crackpot who claims that Jack the Ripper could have committed these crimes.
Oh, well, okay.
Spoiler, no. I did have more than a couple more clips, but I'm just gonna skip to the last one.
Yeah, okay.
Because first of all, one of them I only clipped because he starts out saying, it's interesting, and then I'm like, is it? Like, that's the only reason I was really gonna play it. Is so that we could crack on it, but this clip does refer to the deep dive that Texas Monthly's outstanding reporter Skip Hollinsworth did on this case back in 2000. We will link to that in the show notes, and I suspect everyone's better off just reading that and frankly anything else that Skip Hollinsworth or Pamela Koloff ever wrote for Texas Monthly, who before it pivoted last year to lifestyle had some of the best crime coverage, period. But yeah, that it's like 8 minutes in, they're like, how did this serial killer elude police? Like
it was 1885.
Yeah. Police were literally using like a ruler that was hewn out of a stick with little hash marks on it. Oh God. Yeah. And then finally, halfway through the runtime, they get Harold Schechter, who was like the first and last word on American serial killers, basically, and has written a gazillion books about Ed Gein, about H.H. Holmes, to explain that serial murderers have always existed and, in fact, are probably why legends like vampires and werewolves arose, is because people could not understand this as human behavior.
Yeah.
So they made up supernatural reasons for it. But it's always existed. Like, why was Harold not put in at the top of the show? And then this was like a 15-minute webisode?
Yeah.
Who's to say? Here's Harold.
Serial murder is a very recent term for an age-old phenomenon. In the past, it used to be called lust murder. And these are killers who derive their deepest pleasure from committing certain kinds of sexual atrocities.
What you're saying is that this is as old as the human species, probably.
Many people have a misconception about what serial murder is. Many people feel it began with Ted Bundy or John Wayne Gacy or Charles Manson. I think it's important for people to recognize that this is a feature, you know, of human culture and has always been that.
I kind of felt like he was going to say, this is a feature, not a bug. Like, dude. Fortunately, that's not where it went. Like, this is just, this never really catches fire, this show, and is full of, this is definitely a case where I think I spend enough time with this topic that I am more impatient than a civilian might be with some of their, could this have been a serial killer? Like, yes.
So many rhetorical questions.
Stipulated. But this really is just generally like, it's a show for people who have just arrived from space.
Yeah.
I don't understand how cops work, even. Never mind this other stuff. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say this strikes me as, and this is not a slam on any budget that any PBS show gets. PBS's budget should be 100 times whatever it is. But the sending these people to quote report unquote this quote story unquote, like, and see them, you know, in various picturesque locations in Austin, which Austin is a beautiful city and its downtown is very historic and there's lots of really like cool, interesting architecture for sure. That part of it was kind of interesting, but like then I would rather just watch a show about the buildings. It felt like we need to spend this money or we're not going to get it next year, so let's go to Austin.
Yeah. Or like, here's a map and here I'm in the rare books room. Like, okay, cool. Like, yeah. I'm not uninterested in that stuff. And I was like, oh, I know Congress. Yeah. I know that that's a thing. I've mm-hmm. been on that.
Sure.
Probably. Mm-hmm. Were there any interesting locations for you that you were like, oh, that's where that, I don't know, taco place is? I did cut a, they had a thing of like a bunch of dudes in this neighborhood standing out front of a boot shop. And I cut this picture and was like, that's where we'd have been mm-hmm. 120 years ago. Anything that you recognized?
Yeah, there's one that was on that I've driven past a million times on Guadalupe that like this historic home. I mean, I didn't write down what it was. Like I will confess, like this did not hold my interest. Like I tried, but
I know it, you did. I'm sorry.
This is not for me. This is a level of true crime nerdery that will never work on me.
Well, and for a true crime nerd, it doesn't work either.
Okay.
Like,
great.
I'm just not sure who. I think this is for, you know, school.
Right.
Like,
right.
Students, sure. I guess. If I had it to do again, I would assign us the American experience about the island murders. Ooh. About Thalia Massey. This is a pretty famous case from Hawaii, so.
Oh, sure.
Next time. If we're doing a, if you consent to come back after this snooze fest.
Hey, the cold, our lead topic was great. Most Wanted was definitely worth it. And then this also happened and it was fine.
Yes. Well, now we know. And once again, I think if you're interested in this case, but we have done the right job not selling you on watching the show. Sorry, History Detectives. The Skip Hollandsworth piece, which I believe is turned into a book, will be linked in the show notes.
There you go.
Speaking of linking to things, Tara, plug your shit. Where else can people find you?
Okay. You can find me every Monday with you, Sarah D. Bunting, on the Again With This podcast starting April 1st. And this is not a prank. We will be alternating episodes of Beverly Hills 90210 and episodes of Melrose Place. So the episode on the pilot of Melrose Place drops April 1st. And then you can also find me every Wednesday, also with Sarah D. Bunting and our other spouse, David T. Cole, on the Extra Hot Great podcast, which is a general interest TV podcast.
Indeed. Thanks so much for coming back.
Of course.
All right, folks, coming up on The Blotter Presents, Mike Dunn on an extremely weird documentary, Screwball, about A-Rod and the Biogenesis scandal, and a couple of properties on Madeline McCann. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. Like the podcast? Please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. Don't like the podcast? Keep it to yourself. My guest has been Tara Ariano, and she is on Twitter at Tara Ariano. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.